And I remember the drum solo, I wasn't accustomed to the high altitude. And I had a drum solo that was pretty much scripted. I went from one part to the next, and I got about halfway through, and I thought, oh my goodness, am I going to make it to the end of this?
You were low on oxygen?
Yes, I was, but we survived it.
Yeah, it was a great show.
So that was Canned Heat, who had the hit song On the Road Again?
Yep.
Okay. What happened with Creedence Clearwater Revival?
We ended up down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we waited for a week. We still hadn't heard much from them, and we ended up playing a job at the University of Phoenix, I believe on there, right? Phoenix mm-hmm. or Albuquerque or University of Albuquerque, or was it Phoenix? One of those places we ended up going, Dave Anthony booked a job for us. Then we did a couple of bar jobs down there while we were waiting. And then after 3 weeks of waiting down there, staying at this motel, we found out that Tom and John did not get along. And Tom was leaving the band, Creedence Clearwater, to start his own band, the Blue Ridge Rangers. And the tour never came about. And I don't believe the band did much after that.
So you're sitting there in a motel in Albuquerque for 3 weeks waiting for a phone call
to start this tour with Creedence Clearwater, and we ended up doing, I think, probably about 4 or 5 jobs down there that we played at different places.
I imagine that was a frustrating 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Looking at the phone? And
Well, every day we thought it would be over tomorrow.
Yeah.
Never happened.
Do you ever sit and wonder, what if we got the job opening for Creedence Clearwater?
Maybe back then I probably did, but right now I don't think I ever thought that.
So what happens next, Peter?
Well, in August, I was having a lot of stress, a lot of neck pain, back pain. I thought I was being so smart to put my drum set so spread out and the cymbals so high, and that came back to haunt me physically. At the end of August, I left Joker's Wild, stopped playing drums, and haven't played since.
Was that a hard decision for you to make?
Oh, terribly hard. Terribly hard. I love the music. I love the lifestyle. I love the guys I was working with. I liked working with Dave and Anthony. But I just couldn't do it anymore. And I didn't want to pull back and just be a drummer that sits behind a nice little kit. It just didn't fit me.
Were you inspired by any national or local drummers or...
Oh, definitely. I was really inspired by Ringo, because that's the person that got me started. And of course, Keith Moon, Ginger Baker, and Bobby Elliott from the Hollies were drummers that I just really thought a lot of. But locally, and probably even more importantly, was a guy named Rod Eaton from the Underbeats. When I was learning how to play drums, he's the person I watched. And every night I'd see him, I'd learn something, go home and practice it, and go out and see him again. Tom Nystrom and Phil Berdahl were also drummers that I admired.
How about you, Danny? Any bass players that inspired you or that you liked?
I liked bass players. I liked Jack Bruce from Cream. He dazzled me. There was Chris Squire from the band Yes, and also Gerald Jamont from, he played with B.B. King's band.
So, Pete, you leave the band, and who takes over on drums?
We had, Pete had let us know a couple of weeks ahead of time that he would be leaving the band, and that was very kind of him. And what we did was we started advertising for drummers. We tried out many different people. We had, what was the name of the studio? Dial Communications, which is a recording studio on 13th and University Northeast. David Anthony arranged to have our band have that studio for a while to try and find a new drummer and get settled in. So we tried out a lot of different people, and finally one day Bill Gent had popped in there, and we liked what we heard, and we started practicing with him on probably September 1st, and by the 7th we were playing our first job. But Bill Gent joined on drums, and we had ended up playing the rest of the year under the name Joker's Wild, even though we changed our name to Flash Tuesday. That was a big thing back then. If you changed a member, it wasn't going to be the same band, and there was no way we would have the same show without Pete and stuff like that. So we changed our name to Flash Tuesday, September 1st of 69. But all the contracts that we played were Joker's Wild until December 31st, because David Anthony already had the jobs booked. So we didn't start under the name Flash Tuesday on contract until January 1st.
Of what year?
70.
Okay, so what would have been the last job you played contracted for as Joker's Wild.
That would have been probably December 27th of 1969.
So do you remember where that job was?
Wilmer Armory.
So I understand you had a couple different versions of Joker's Wild that played in during the 1971?
Yes. Back then, I'd got together with Ron Honeybear Hort, Lorenzo Whitmarsh, Scotty Holmstrom, Robbie Belleville, and myself. And I can't remember what name we came up with, but we went to a booking agency, and he says, this would be a lot better to get jobs if you were Joker's Wild. So I said, okay, let's do it under Joker's Wild. And I think for January, February, and March of 71, we did jobs under Joker's Wild with that lineup. Then it popped up again in September of 72. Chuck Edwards, Lonnie Knight, myself, and Robbie Belleville went and played probably 2 weeks or 3 weeks together, and we did Cobblestone Ballroom and a few other places with that name, Joker's Wild. Other than that, the name Joker's Wild has not popped up since probably September of 72.
Pete, did you have a favorite place playing in town here?
Oh, boy, I love Magoo's.
Why?
The New City Opera House. A couple of reasons. Always had good crowds. It was a great venue. They had a very psychedelic atmosphere. The ambiance was fabulous. And our peers were there. When they weren't playing, they would come. So it was always fun to play when you had other band members out and about while you're playing.
What do you mean by a psychedelic atmosphere?
Oh, the walls were painted. There was black lighting, bright colors, real strobe lights, and it was the in place to be at that point in time.
Always had a crowd.
Danny, how about you? Any favorite place in town that you'd like to play at?
I think New City Opera House in Magoo's was probably my top at that time, too. We just had a great following there, you know, in town.
How about out of town?
Out of town, probably be Cobblestone Ballroom. We had the biggest crowd. But there were other places, too.
And I love Bloomer, Wisconsin, the Pines Ballroom.
Yeah. Pines Ballroom. That was Bloomer. Fabulous. Yep. We always had a great crowd there, too. London Inn. London Inn. Eau Claire. Always had a great crowd there.
Do you have any recollections of Rice Lake, Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. Played there frequently. And we had one time that we went there that the Star and Tribune came along. And that was an adventure, having two writers follow us for the day. And back then, the Star Tribune had a segment of their paper called the Picture Magazine, and we were the feature story for that Sunday magazine.
That was really unique to have, you know, a reporter and a camera operator right in the van with us.
Do you think they ever recovered?
We wore bells around our neck back then. It was always tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. That's what they heard all the time. But we took them to Rice Lake, Wisconsin. They spent the entire night. They even did interviews and stuff with people in bathrooms and all over the place, and came back with us that night. It was great. We had a great spread in the paper, too.
And it was really well done, I thought.
Yes, yeah.
I thought you had a night in Rice Lake that didn't turn out so good. Or am I thinking of a different city?
Oh, the windows.
Yes. Oh, the windows in the van and stuff like that?
Yes.
That would have been Bloomer.
That was Bloomer?
Bloomer, Wisconsin, the Pines Ballroom. Somebody, one of the band members was getting too much attention from somebody's girlfriend in the crowd, and he went out and punched out of the whole our windows in our van, and we had to call the police and all that stuff. That wasn't a good time.
Any stories on the road that you recall?
Well, I remember one event we were booked for that was on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon in South Dakota. We were at a county fair, and we set up outside in the middle of a stock car racetrack.
Webster, South Dakota.
Webster, South Dakota.
Webster Fairgrounds.
And the audience was primarily young kids and grandparents and a lot of guys in bib overalls. And we thought, you know, our normal songs aren't going to work here at all. So we got up on stage and started telling hippie jokes and things that would degrade ourselves, played some songs in a venue that they would appreciate, and they just loved us. It was the silliest, funniest thing we've ever done.
But they liked your jokes.
They liked the jokes.
Speaking of jokes, what's the story about Pinky Dufort?
Oh, boy, I don't know how you heard about that, but we worked hard to present a show that was moving all the time. So whenever the technology would fail us, or the cords wouldn't work, or the amps would blow a fuse, which was quite frequently,
you'd have dead space and you'd have to do space. Something.
And if the PA was going, somebody had to get up to the mic and entertain. And I oftentimes, being you didn't have to plug the drums in, was the one that would get stuck with doing that. Well, I'm not that good at it, first off, and I had almost no material. And Denny was the leader of the band, and he recognized that. And he sent away to New York City for a, back then it was a mimeographed packet of jokes from Pinky Dufort, and they were just horrible, horrible one-liners. And if you have enough of them, you know, you can really do some serious damage.
So you were the one who had to fill in the dead space.
Yes.
He had to be the Rodney Dangerfield and have all these one-liners that he would be telling the audience. And sometimes it went over really well. Sometimes it didn't. You hear the moans and the laughter, you know, you dealt with it.
So in 1990, a compilation album comes out called The Best of Metro Beat. Joker's Wild winds up with 5 songs on there. That's a pretty good number of songs by one band.
That's great, you know. We were really impressed to have that many songs on that album.
Do you recall your first reunion concert in September 1998 at the Fine Line?
Yep, the Fine Line. It went over great. It was for, the Mill City Blues Festival
Mill City Music Festival?
Yeah, Mill City Music Festival. And we were booked down there with all different bands, The Litter, The Still Roving Crow. Everybody was at that show, and it was like a class reunion. It was just great. We had a ball playing it.
Pete, do you recall that show?
Oh, boy, do I ever. I hadn't played for almost 30 years. My old music teacher said that for every day you don't practice, you lose 2.
Right.
So, boy, I was really behind. But Denny and Lonnie were pretty patient with me as I got caught back up on all the songs, and it was wonderful. It was a good night.
And a few months after that, you were at the Caboose.
And Tom, I believe you emceed that show.
I believe I did.
Yep, at the Caboose with Crow and the Still Roving and the Litter. And who else was on that show?
Joker's Wild, the Litter, the Crow, and the Still Roving.
Yep.
And then on September 18, 2010, Joker's Wild were inducted into the Mid-America Music Hall of Fame at the Sheraton Bloomington.
Yep.
And at that concert were Lonnie Knight, Denny Johnson, Pete Huber, and Bill Jordan. Was that a good time?
Yes, it was good to get everybody back together. I wanted Kink Middlemiss to be on that show, too, just to have a keyboard player, but he felt he wouldn't fit in.
And I thought it was, again, as someone who's been away from music for a number of years, it was the first time I'd played live with drums that were actually mic'd.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and it was just such a different experience to actually be able to hear the drums.
Good show.
Good show.
I understand in January 2013, Denny, you got contacted by Shaddix Music out of Germany. What was the story there?
They had contacted me through email and asked if I was interested in signing on with them and having them put out Joker's Wild songs. And I'd gotten back to them and told them I wasn't interested because everybody that I heard that did those kind of things always got kind of screwed and it didn't happen. I didn't realize that the same time they sent Lonnie Knight the same thing, and Lonnie Knight says, yeah, we're interested, we'll do it. And then I told Pete Huber about it, and Pete Huber goes, nothing's happening with us right now, why don't we do something? So those two convinced me to change my mind, and ended up listening to what they had to say and talking with Thomas Hartledge a few times. Eventually, we'd signed a 5-year contract with them for Joker's Wild, and they asked for probably about, what, I think they got 21 songs and 100 pictures. So they ended up putting out Joker's Wild Liquid Giraffe.
So your album, which started in 1969...
gets released.
Is released in 2013.
Yes, it was released September of 2013. And the CD was released in November of 2013.
And the gentleman in Storm Lake, his name was Lauren Cave.
Yes, Lauren.
Who came up with the name Liquid Giraffe. Do we have any idea on how many albums they pressed up?
I think they were going to do 500 albums and 1,000 CDs, but we haven't heard anything from them since.
So how did that feel after all these years to have your Liquid Giraffe album come out?
Well, I thought their pressing of the album was fabulous. And the use of the pictures and how the cover came together and the whole package really impressed me.
I thought they did a super job. I thought it was done great. Me and Pete actually mastered it here in this studio. We mastered the album here and then sent it to him. So everything that's on that was done here and mastered at Sunrise.
And what did you think of the quality of the sound?
I thought it was good.
Now, talking about the Liquid Giraffe album, it's kind of hard not to talk about these outfits that the band is wearing. They're kind of, what would you say?
Spacey?
Spacey, Star Trek-ish. How would you describe them, Peter?
Boy, I don't know how to describe them. It looks like something someone stepping off of a spaceship might have been wearing. But it was interesting. We somehow got connected with a group of young ladies from St. Catherine's College that I believe they were involved with a play and had worked with the wardrobe part of that play. And the play was over and they had these costumes. And somehow someone steered them onto us. And we went through what they had and found one with sleeves long enough that Lonnie could actually wear it. So we bought three of them and they were pretty nice costumes for us.
And they were kind of all the same but different because we needed something for the different personalities. I think yours was green, mine was blue, and Lonnie's was silver and black, right?
Yep. Some had stars, some had moons.
Yep.
And there's also some, I guess I would say, psychedelic artwork on the front cover. Do we know who did that?
Actually, Lonnie Knight started it, but some other, after he got to a certain point, they sent it to a graphics artist guy and he finished it.
I'm glad you mentioned graphic artist because we have to bring in a local musician here by the name of Dale Strength, who came up with the, would you call it the logo?
Yes, the logo are buttons.
For Joker's Wild, the buttons?
The orange buttons with the logo, little thing we used for logo for a long time.
Did you actually make actual buttons and
yes,
pass them out at concerts or sell them? Or?
Yep, I think we just gave them away.
We
printed up 500 buttons and we just gave them away to all kinds of people. I still have one or two.
And flipping the Liquid Giraffe album cover over to the backside shows the three-piece band playing live. Do we know where that was taken?
That photo was taken at the Hullabaloo Club in the Shorewood Shopping Center over in Fridley. And what they did was they took Joker's Wild off the drum heads and imposed it over the back Hullabaloo where it says Joker's Wild in the back there. That usually said Hullabaloo. So they kind of used their own graphic artists and changed that photo.
And you've got the same outfits on there,
yep,
as on the front. And the lower photo, that has the drapes in the back, so I'm assuming that's the Labor Temple, right?
Yes. One interesting thing about the top photo on the back of the album cover is we talked earlier about the experimental amps from Fender. Those are pictures of what those amps look like.
So these are your homemade amplifiers here.
Yep.
That caused great consternation amongst fellow musicians who couldn't figure out what they were.
And where we got them.
Ah.
We couldn't tell. It was a secret. We were under contract.
You could have said they were Joker's Wild amplifiers.
No. Never say you make your own. Say somebody gave them to us.
We didn't even
experimental.
Say that. We just said we're not allowed to talk about it.
Yep. How critical was it for the success of Joker's Wild, do you think, to have David Anthony Wachter as the booking agent for the band?
I felt we were really fortunate that we were involved with David. He had a focus that was primarily out of the Twin City area. He was focused in the regional ballrooms, and we were really fortunate to be with him. We almost always got paid, with one or two exceptions where the promoters had problems such as blizzards or something unforeseen. So the paperwork business part of it was always well done. He never took advantage of any of his bands that I'm aware of. And that's pretty exceptional in this industry. I just felt we were very lucky to have David as our manager. And we're still very good friends today.
Yep.
Danny?
No, I say the same thing. I mean, David was a treat to work with, and I actually, even after Joker's Wild, had quite a relationship with him for business-wise with the Tubin and Somersets and all the other different things that we did. Yeah, David was a treat to work with. He really was. He believed in you and he pushed hard for you.
So looking back over the history of Joker's Wild, is there any one memory that stands out as something very special to you, or maybe more than one memory?
It's just all kind of a cluster. I really, you know, from playing with the Shadows of Night to playing with the Association to playing with the National Acts was just great. And then when we got to the point of drawing huge, huge numbers at like Cobblestone Ballroom and that, you know, when you went out there and they were all screaming for you, it was great. It was a fun ride. I wouldn't give it up for the world.
And Peter? I agree with Denny, and it was a treat for me as a drummer to play with guys like Denny and Lonnie. They could think on their feet. They would do things that were so different than the other guitar players were doing at that point in time. Just to be able to be part of a band where you're really proud of the work that they were doing was a treat for me.